The Shoreshin Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Hello everyone, this is Bill and this is a Torah portion commentary on the Torah portion called Korach. Korach, of course, is found in Bamidbar, chapter 16, verse 1, goes through chapter 18, verse 32. Now, in the last portion, the people threatened to appoint a captain to lead them back to Egypt because of the spies report. In this portion, instead of complaining about a particular issue, lack of water, not the right kind of food, giants in the land, those kinds of things, the people actually begin to rebel outright against God. And it follows two parallel paths. It's very widespread, but those who led it are prompted by slightly different things. In the end, those who led this rebellion, Korach and Dathan and Abiram, are destroyed by different acts of God. This particular rebellion is, like I said, not a grumbling against God for the fact we don't think we have enough to eat or we don't have enough water or this, that, or the other. But it's actually an attempt to overthrow Moses and to overthrow Aaron amid accusations of abuse of power and nepotism and these kinds of things. And there are many factors that are believed to have fueled this rebellion. One of them is that the Kohanim, the priests, of course, were to replace the firstborn. And Korach and his 250 followers, it's believed, were firstborn. And so they've got a problem with the fact that the priests were to replace the firstborn. They, or Korach anyway, wants to be the priest. Korach and his followers were Levites, or a lot of his followers were Levites. And specifically, Korach was of the Kohathites. Now, the Kohathites, of course, are the segment of Levi that were to transport the Ark of the Covenant, the menorah, the Table of Showbread, and things like this. Very high profile, you'd say. But Korach and his followers aren't satisfied with that. Now, on the other path, we've got Dathan and Abiram, who are of Reuben. They were of that tribe. And, of course, that tribe was the firstborn tribe. But Reuben had lost his firstborn status to Joseph. And so we've got these two jealousies at work here. They're kind of born out of the same thing. They just follow different paths, so to speak, but they end up at the same place. And that is, they don't want Moses running the show. They don't want Aaron running the show. But consequently, that means they don't want God running the show. Now, it's also interesting to point out that Reuben's camp, which was to the south of the Mishkan, was situated very close to where the Kohathites camped, which was also to the south of the Mishkan. And, of course, Korach, being a Kohathite, was very close to Dathan and Abiram, these two Reubenites. So this close proximity, of course, plays a role in this rebellion. And it's interesting, as a southerner, to say that the rebellion came from the south. Anyway, at any rate, after the decision was made that all those who were over 20 must die, those who had believed the report of the spies, apparently these malcontents seized upon the opportunity that was given them to say, look, you know, this is all happening because of Moses and Aaron. But now when their destruction came, it was obviously God's doing. In other words, God was making it very clear that he was the one who had chosen Moses and Aaron. And so the vindication of Moses and Aaron had to be complete, and it had to be without question. Now later on, when the people of Israel do go into the land, interestingly enough, Levi, Kohath, if you will, but Levi is kind of dispersed throughout the land amongst all the tribes. And Reuben was actually situated across the Jordan River, kind of on the outskirts of all the rest of the people. In other words, these two that had initiated this widespread rebellion were kind of removed from one another. They didn't hang out with one another anymore. Now, one of the things to consider is, as we get into this, is that Korach is related to Moses. They are cousins. And so it's interesting to see, and maybe interesting is not the right word, maybe it's a little disheartening, but nonetheless, we see that many times these attacks that come, we shouldn't be surprised when they come from those who are closest to us. We see that Moses has already come under attack from Miriam and from Aaron, and now he's coming under attack from Korah. In fact, Aaron's coming under attack from Korah as well. And so sometimes these attacks come from those who are the closest to you, those who are related to you. Tradition says that the way Korah went about this was to try to show that the laws that Moses were imposing upon the people were too difficult and too hard. He was trying to use that as his way of getting power by pretending to be an advocate for the people. But really what he's doing is, by implication, is saying that God's laws are too tough and God's laws are too imposing. And so we need another leader. And I'm going to be an advocate for the people, in reality, against God's instructions, which is exactly what Nimrod does. But I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here. So let's get into chapter 16 and look at this rebellion. Of course, it begins in verse 1 by telling us the names of the people who lead this rebellion. And it's, of course, Korah, who is called a son of Kohath, who is the son of Levi. And then we have Dathan and Abiram and On, who are all sons of Reuben. Now, tradition teaches us that On, even though he's mentioned here, later on when destruction comes, his name is not mentioned. And it's suggested that On changed his mind. He backed out of following the others, and the tradition is that it was his wife who convinced him to do this. Whether or not that's true, we don't know, but it is true that he's mentioned here as being one of the ringleaders, and yet he's not mentioned later as being those who continue to resist Moses and Aaron and who go to their deaths. Now, it says that they took, implying men. But some argue that it means they took themselves, that is, they separated themselves from Moses. And in verse 2, they rose up in the face of Moses, that is to say, in opposition to Moses. In fact, Korah was joined in this opposition to Moses with princes of the congregation, that is, leaders of the different tribes. They were prestigious men who, by their presence, gave credibility to Korah's protests. Now, the term that is rendered in the face of, or in the face of Moses, would be lifne, or lifne Moshe, in the face of, which is opposition to. They're challenging him. They're opposing him. That's interesting to me because lifne is the same term that is used in Genesis chapter 10, verse 9, when it says of Nimrod that he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. The word before is literally, in Hebrew, lifne, or he is a mighty hunter in the face of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. So in other words, Nimrod was in opposition to God, just as Korah was in opposition to Moses. And so if Korah's ambition and objective was to topple Moses, then we could argue that Nimrod's objective was to topple God. So, either way you look at it, Korah, Nimrod, they're doing the same thing. They're opposing God. So, because Nimrod was opposing God and wanting to, quote-unquote, topple God, Korah was in opposition to God as well. He just tries to make it that it's Moses that he has a problem with. But ultimately, it's God. And so, consequently, Korah finds himself in the company of other rebels and other infamous personalities. Jude records it this way in verse 10 and 11. But these people blaspheme all they do not understand, and they are destroyed by all that they, like unreasoning animals, understand instinctively. Woe to them! For they walked in the way of Cain, a rebel, and abandoned themselves for the sake of gain to Balaam's error, someone who just couldn't overcome that evil inclination in his heart. and perished in Korach's rebellion. And so it's the same kind of people, the type of personality that prompts a Cain to do what he did, or a Balaam to do what he did, are the same kind of people who perished in Korach's rebellion. They all have the same issues. They all have the same problems. Now, joining him, as we said, were these elect men, these men of renown. In fact, the term there is Inshe Shem. Men, Inshe, or the word is Anash, Shem, name. Literally, name there is to say authority. Men of authority. That's what's joining Korach in this rebellion. And so that's interesting because that's the same term that we find in Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, when it describes the Nephilim, men of renown. Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, it says the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God came into the daughters of man and they bore children to them. These, referring to the Nephilim, were the mighty men who were of old the men of renown. The only distinction that's in the Hebrew text that's made here between the men of renown of Genesis 6:4 and the men of renown in Korach's rebellion is the definite article, hey, which is translated the, is present in Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. In other words, instead of in Sheshem, it says in Shehashem. So the men of renown, as opposed to men of renown. But the point is, it's still speaking of men of authority. And in Genesis 6, it is the men of authority that I believe, these men of renown, that actually compel the sons of God in Genesis 6 to mix and to mingle with the daughters of men. And we don't have time to develop that here. We cover that in other teachings. The point is, again, it's the men of renown, the men of authority, who entice, seduce, compel, coerce, whatever words you'd like to use, the sons of God, God's people, into mixing, into mingling with the daughters of men, and that ultimately leads to the corruption of the earth, according to Genesis 6, 11, and 12. So then likewise, it's interesting that it is men of renown, or men of name, or men of authority, that along with Korach, Dathan, and Abiram lead the people of God, Israel, to rebel against God. In both cases, those who submitted to the leadership of these men of renown, in Genesis 6 and here in Numbers, all of them died. It didn't turn out good. Now in verse 3, Korach makes this statement, "You take too much upon yourselves, seeing the whole congregation is holy." Now, one thing that jumps out at me here is Korach fails to recognize that there are those who are set apart from those who have been set apart. In other words, yes, it is true that the whole congregation was to be set apart, but he doesn't recognize, apparently, that there are those who are set apart from those who are set apart, and God's the one who determines that. And so Korach feigns representing the people and what's in the interest of the people against this alleged tyranny of Moses. But that's the same thing Nimrod does in Genesis chapter 10 and 11. He kind of postures himself as being the one who is going to represent the people and the good of the people against God's quote-unquote oppressive rule. Because in Genesis chapter 11, verse 4, here's what it says. Then they said, and Nimrod, of course, is behind the building of Babylon because that was the beginning of his kingdom, according to verse 9 and 10 of chapter 10. They said, "Come and let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, our authority, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth." So when Noah and his sons departed the ark, God had instructed them to be fruitful and to multiply. And in Hebrew, the word multiply insinuates spreading out. We planted some black-eyed Susans in a flower bed several years ago, and we planted just a few plants. Well, each year, as those black-eyed Susans have come back, They have multiplied. And in multiplying, they are spreading out. That's what's meant. And so, in other words, he told Noah and sons to spread out. But Nimrod is compelling the people to come together, to defy the Creator. Let's resist his laws and commands because, you know, look, they're too tough. We don't want to do that. We want to do what we want to do. We want to establish our authority. And so, in appealing to the people's desires and wants and quote-unquote needs, let's build a city, let's build a tower, let's come and make a name for ourselves, because we don't want to be dispersed over the whole earth, pretending to represent the people and to be a man of the people, he's really out to be a rebel against God. And Korach is doing the same thing. Judas, when in the Gospel of John, chapter 12, it says, when this woman brings this ointment and anoints Yeshua's feet, he says, why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor? So he's pretending to represent the poor by rebuking the woman who had this very expensive ointment. Kind of sounds familiar. People rebuking those who have something very expensive in the name of the poor. But he said this, John records, not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. And having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. In other words, he pretends to want to help the poor, want to be a representative of the people. But yet, really, his true objective is to pursue his own agenda, to line his own pockets, or in the case of Korach and Nimrod, to build his own kingdom, to establish his authority. And so it is with rebels. They pretend to represent the people, but they only seek power for themselves. In some cases, they say they represent the poor and the downtrodden and the oppressed. But all they do is use the poor and the oppressed as fodder in order to advance their own goals and agenda. Now, it is pointed out in some commentaries that when Korah is addressing holiness, he only addresses the holiness of the people at large, but avoids the issue of individual holiness of the people. In other words, he's not going to call too much attention to the fact that individuals have the responsibility to be holy in order for the people to be holy. So he speaks only of communal holiness, where Moses speaks of the individual holiness and the one that God chooses. Now, instead of interceding for them, as he has often done in times past, at this point Moses falls on his face. And perhaps it's because he realizes they've gone too far. But in verse 5 he says this, "The Lord will show you who are his and who is holy." And the his, who are his, refers to the Levites, and the one who is holy would refer to Aaron the high priest. But he's going to show you that. And this was to address the fact that Korah really wants the position for himself. It's not that he cares so much about the people. It's simply that he wants to be chief. And Moses is really pointing that out. But in verse 6, in order to determine this, or to validate this, Moses instructs them that they are to bring censers, that all of this is going to be determined. We're going to get the answer to this, and it's going to be accomplished through the incense service. And so, in a way, here's what Moses is doing. He's going to say, okay, you're going to get your chance to be the priest. He's going to permit them to function equally with Aaron and his sons. And so, when you do that, God's going to determine who is acceptable and who is holy. In other words, what he's saying is, you know, if you want to be the priest and you want to act like the priest, okay, then you need to deal with the consequences of doing this. In other words, there is the potential for death in this. Because remember, Nadav and Avihu perished when they presented unacceptable incense, and they were sons of Aaron. So if you want to be the priest, get your censers and offer your incense, and we'll see what God says. And so you can prove your argument, Korach, by offering incense. And those who are with you can prove their argument by offering incense. And if you live, then you've proven your point. But if you're wrong, you're going to die. And so how far had these people gone when they could have, when they convinced themselves that this was going to turn out okay? How far they had drifted from truth, or how evil some of these people must have been to convince themselves that, you know, I'm going to rebel against God and I'm just going to prove this here. So rabbinically, it is understood that, like the spies who gave an evil report and whose eyes had caused them to err, Korah's eyes had caused him to err as well. And so at that point, verse 7, Moses turns their words upon them and says, "You take too much upon you, sons of Levi." And he continues on by rebuking Korah for not being satisfied with just being a Levite or even a Kohathite. Because again, he is one of those who is given the responsibility of carrying the holy furniture. And so he's basically saying, aren't you content with this? But verse 10, he says, so you want the priesthood too? So here's a classic example of not being willing to function in your purpose. You're not content with your job, so you want the other guy's job because you think it's more prestigious. You think there's more limelight attached to it or more spotlight. But what people don't often understand is, along with that quote-unquote spotlight, also comes a lot more responsibility. But all people see is that, you know, I'm living this mundane life, and I would rather live this more glamorous life that this guy's got. But they don't understand that the Creator is the one who determines who does what. And the Creator determines if you're to do this, then you're not supposed to be doing that. And so he doesn't want to function in his purpose. He wants the other guy's role. Notice a kind of a similar situation in the Gospel of John, chapter 21, verse 18. Yeshua speaks to Peter and he says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go." This he said to show by what kind of death he, that is Peter, was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, "Follow me." Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Yeshua loved following them, the one who had been reclining at table close to him and had said, "Lord, who is it that is going to betray you?" And when Peter saw him, he said to Yeshua, "Lord, what about this man?" Yeshua said to him, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." So the saying spread abroad among the brothers that this disciple was not to die. Yet Yeshua did not say to him that he was not to die, but, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you?" In other words, Peter seems to be overly concerned about what's going to happen to this other disciple, more so than on focusing on that he should follow the Messiah. The point that I believe Yeshua is making is, focus on what you're supposed to do. Focus on your job. And your job is to focus on me. Follow me where I direct you. Don't be worrying about the other guy. Don't be worrying about what he's doing or what he's not doing or what he gets to do or what you don't get to do. You focus on your purpose. And you can only do that if you are focused on me and following me and doing what I tell you to do. So Korah became focused on Aaron's role rather than his own. And because he's focused on Aaron's role, he, like the spies, commits error with his eye. Because his motivation became self-promotion and self-aggrandizement. And so he was discontent with not being the focus of everybody. And so, in a manner of speaking, he got his eyes off the Creator. He got his eyes off the Master. And in getting his eyes off the Master, he got his eyes on himself, and that caused him to err and to lead others in error. And many believers, I believe, fall into the same trap. Verse 11 tells us that they are gathered together against the Lord, that these people are gathered against the Lord. You're not rebelling against me, in other words. You're rebelling against God. You're in the face, lifne, of God. You're opposing Him. And so Moses acknowledges that that's what this is really all about. And as to Aaron, why are you murmuring against him? He wasn't self-appointed. God appointed him. So really, once again, this isn't about me. This isn't about Aaron. This is about God. Now, it seems then that at this point, some of the Levites, including the sons of Korah, distanced themselves from this rebellion. And I say that because later on we see in Numbers 26, verse 11, that the sons of Korah did not die. Later on in the Psalms, we see that the sons of Korah wrote many of the Psalms. In fact, Psalms 44 through 49 are all written by the sons of Korah. So we understand that Korah's sons were not destroyed, which would imply that at some point they distanced themselves from their father and from this rebellion. And maybe it is when Moses makes it very clear, you're not rebelling against me, you're rebelling against God. So we see that the sons of Korah were not destroyed, they did not die, and thus we learn that the Creator is able and is willing to distinguish, even within a household, those who wish to follow Him and those who do not follow Him. Now, in chapter 16, verse 12, we see Dathan and Abiram, both who apparently had not been part of the previous conversation between Moses and Korah, are called by Moses, but they refuse to answer the call. In fact, they said, "We will not come up." Literally, "We will not ascend." And Rashi considers this to be a prophecy when they say, "We will not ascend." Well, that's correct. They didn't. They descended. And so when they said, "We will not ascend," they more or less sealed their fate by descending. In verse 13, they accused Moses of misleading the people for the sake of power. They said this, "You brought us out of a land flowing with milk and honey." And so they apply to Egypt the very words that Moses uses to describe Canaan. But it's not just Moses who uses those words to describe Canaan, because as far as we know, Moses had never been to Canaan. And so Moses is relying on the testimony of the Creator Himself, who says in Exodus chapter 3, verse 8, "I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites." So it's God's testimony that it is a land flowing with milk and honey. And Dathan and Abiram have the gall to say, "Moses, you brought us out of a land flowing with milk and honey." And so they accuse Moses, and by extension God, of bringing them into the wilderness in order to kill them. Ironically, God brought them into the wilderness in order to save them. They ended up killing themselves. And that death that came about is a result of their disobedience, because disobedience is inherently deadly. What I mean by that is, so many times people have the idea that if we disobey, God will kill. I don't think it's so much that as it is, if we disobey, the law of disobedience is death. In other words, we kill ourselves. Now, they go on to contend that Moses can't bring them into Canaan. This is insinuated by the fact that they had just lost this battle against the Amalekites and the Amorites, and because that battle blocked their passage into the land of Canaan, that somehow or another that's Moses' fault, even though they ignore the fact that Moses told them not to do it, and they ignore the fact that the reason that happened is because the people believed the spies' report and doubted God. But usually, people who get their eyes on themselves and all they can think about is what they want, and they despise the other person, they tend to ignore the facts of the case, and they begin to make all these excuses. And they end up accusing somebody of something that they themselves are guilty of. And I believe that this is one of those cases. They're the ones who made it for them anyway, impossible to enter into the land. It wasn't Moses. Now, verse 15, an apparently very angry Moses requests of the Lord, do not respect their offering. Tomorrow, when they come to bring their incense offering, please do not respect their offering. He's been accused of tyranny. And Moses says, I haven't taken one thing from them. If I was a tyrant, I would be taking this, that, and the other. I haven't taken one thing from them. And reading between the lines, what you could hear Moses thinking is, they've taken from me. Now, it says that the next day, Korah assembled all the congregation against them at the door of the Mishkan. And apparently, he had been able to influence a large number of the tribes. So, what I glean from this is, once you have tares sown amongst the wheat, you cannot easily uproot the tares without uprooting the wheat. Because that becomes very clear in the parable. However, I do believe that the Creator has the ability to uproot the tares without largely damaging the wheat. And what we see here in this rebellion, that's exactly what he's going to do. Now, verse 21, it says that God tells Moses and Aaron, separate yourselves from the people that I may consume them. Once again, God's telling Moses, get out of the way. I'm going to wipe these folks out. But once again, we see Moses interceding for the people. And it's based on the fact that, or his intercession is based on the fact that God can discern between the guilty and those who are led astray by the guilty. He says, shall one man sin and you be angry with the whole congregation? So Moses seeks mercy for those who don't know what they're doing. In other words, judge the guilty, but spare the innocent. Spare the misguided. David makes the same prayer more or less in 2 Samuel chapter 24, verse 17. It's kind of an interesting thing that he's the guilty party in that particular prayer. But nonetheless, he says that David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking the people and said, behold, I have sinned and I have done wickedly. But these sheep, what have they done? Please let your hand be against me and against my father's house. So, in other words, judge the guilty. Don't let everybody be punished because of one person. Another example is found in the account of Abraham when he was pleading for those who were living in Sodom or Sodom. In Genesis 18, verse 25, he says, far be it from you to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be that from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? So in other words, in this particular instance with Abraham and with David and with Moses, what we see is that it is indicative of those who have a heart after God, because God is long-suffering and merciful. It's indicative of those who have a heart after God to appeal to his mercy and the fact that he is long-suffering, and to distinguish between the guilty and those who may have been led astray by the guilty. In verses 23 through 26, God responds to Moses, and so then he instructs the people to separate themselves from the rebels. In other words, God gave them a chance to separate themselves to demonstrate who they were loyal to. And of course, this reminds us of what happened after the golden calf incident when Moses calls upon those who were on the Lord's side. And this is when the tribe of Levi, ironically, separated themselves from the rest of the people. But nonetheless, God gave opportunity to the people before the destruction came to demonstrate whose side they were on. Where do your loyalties lie? Another example of this is the destruction that came to the cities of the plain. Before the destruction came, the warning to flee came. Because God gives everybody an opportunity who is willing to return from wickedness. He wants them to have an opportunity to live. So Lot was warned to leave with his family from Sodom before the destruction. In fact, in Genesis 19, beginning at verse 15, here's what it says. As morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city. But he lingered. So the men seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, the Lord being merciful to him. And they brought him out and set him outside the city. And as they brought him out, one said, "Escape for your life. Do not look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Escape to the hills, lest you be swept away." And then going on down to verse 22, it says, "Escape there quickly, this city that Lot had pointed to, for I can do nothing till you arrive there." So what we glean from this, God doesn't wish that the righteous and the guiltless perish along with the wicked and the guilty. However, it is incumbent upon the righteous and the guiltless to separate themselves from the guilty and from the wicked. And it is the responsibility of the righteous to heed the warning that is sent to them to separate themselves from those who are wicked and guilty. Another example is in Luke chapter 21, verse 20, Yeshua says, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are inside the city depart, and let not those who are out in the country enter it, for these are days of vengeance to fulfill all that is written." In other words, what would have happened to those of Yeshua's followers who heard that warning but did not heed that warning? Then we can conclude that they would have perished along with the wicked. So even though God does not wish the righteous to be punished with the wicked, it is still the responsibility of the righteous to heed the warnings that God sends before that destruction comes. It is the responsibilities of the hearers to do what they hear. Now, in verse 27, the people did separate themselves from Korah, from Dathan and Abiram. Now, it tells us that Dathan and Abiram stood defiant in their tents. And so in verse 28 and 9, Moses makes a very bold declaration. He describes the destruction that is going to come and that it would obviously be coming from God in order to put down this rebellion. In other words, he gets so specific and describes something so phenomenal that only God could do it. And that way, the people would know that God is the one who has chosen Moses, and God is the one who has chosen Aaron, and God is the one putting down the rebellion. So take note. And so what he describes is, of course, that the ground would open up and they would go down alive into the pit. The nature of the rebellion is such that it forces Moses to outline a very harsh punishment. Because again, like a cancer, if you do not cut it out, the cancer will eventually destroy the entire body. And so Korah's tactics are like that cancer, and the influence that he's had is like that cancer spreading. And so it has to be put down, and it has to be put down dramatically. Korah's tactics, in fact, are similar to the adversary's tactics in that he is trying to sabotage what God is doing. So he's obviously being a vessel for the adversary, wittingly or unwittingly, we don't know. But nevertheless, it's a cancer. And God, who is loving and caring, who wants the body to live and not die, is well prepared to cut the cancer out when need be. If it's not going to repent, if you're not going to turn, then he'll do what's necessary. And so God honors Moses' prayer. Moses outlines what needs to happen. It's very dramatic. It can't obviously be accomplished by a man. It would obviously be from God. And so he outlines what needs to happen, and God honors his prayer because God honors the prayer of the righteous. Abraham's an example. Elijah's an example. 1 Peter 3 says this, "For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil." So interestingly enough, Korah was in the face of Moses and really God. And so those who get in his face, he sets his face against those. So Moses only prayed this way, and this was my point, to dispel any doubts that God had appointed him and God had appointed Aaron. Because if God didn't do exactly what he laid out, then the people would no longer believe anything that Moses said. But if he does a new thing, literally it says, if he create a creation in that he opens the earth and caused them to go down alive into the pit, then the people would understand that Korah, Aviram, and Dathan had actually opposed the Lord, not Moses. And so if this happens, by implication, you should believe what I tell you from now on, that it comes from him. So then, we deduce this. Korah's rebellion and the rebellion of Dathan and Aviram is equivalent to not believing Moses. Let me say that again. The way Moses outlined things that they should happen to Korah and all that pertained to him and to Dathan and Aviram was so specific that it would prove that God is the one who allowed it to happen, and that in fact these men had been opposing God because they did not believe Moses. So again, Korah's rebellion is equivalent to not believing Moses, and it is equivalent to an attempt to replace those that God has chosen. That's what Korah's rebellion is all about. Now, consider Yeshua's words. In the Gospel of John, he says, "You search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, and they are the ones witnessing of me. And you will not come to me that you may have life. For if you had believed Moses, you would have believed me, for he wrote of me. But if you do not believe his writings, how shall you believe my words?" Refusing to accept what Moses said is equivalent to Korah's rebellion. Yeshua says, you really don't believe me if you don't believe Moses. And if you don't believe Moses, then you're in the same camp as Korah. And so when someone says that what Moses wrote has no validity anymore, what Moses wrote has no applicability to me, that's equivalent to not believing Moses. And not believing Moses is equivalent to Korah's rebellion. Likewise, those who desire to replace those that God has chosen is equal to Korah's rebellion. And so then, could we not argue that replacement theology is wanting to replace those that God has chosen, and that again is equivalent to Korah's rebellion? Now in verses 32 and 33, per Moses' words, we see that the earth opened and it swallowed them alive, and they were taken into Sheol and everything that pertained to them, and then the ground closed up almost as if nothing had happened. Keep it in mind that the sons of Korah survived. Why? Because they had separated themselves. In verse 35, simultaneously, apparently, a fire comes out and destroys the 250 that were standing there with their censers. They were destroyed in much the same way that Nadab and Abihu perished, because they offered profane fire before the Lord when they were doing the incense service. So as we get into chapter 17, we see the aftermath of all this. Now, it is interesting that things that may have been considered unclean before they approached the Lord, once they have approached the Lord, they are consecrated and considered holy and then can't be used for any other purpose. And what I mean by that is this. In verses 2 and 3, the fire pans that these 250 men brought, they became holy. They approached the Lord at the cost of their lives, but those censers became holy and therefore could not be used for any other common purpose from that point forward. In fact, we read that they are beaten into plates and placed upon the brazen altar because they serve as a reminder of the mistake of Korah and Dathan and Aviram and those 250 that dared approach the Lord. So it is to remind Israel, perhaps of many things, but one of them that stands out is, who is to approach the Lord? In the Torah it says, no common man. No common man is to approach the Lord, but only the consecrated man. It also tells us how. That is with a humble heart, not one that's proud. Now in verse 6, it says, yet on the next day, Israel begins to murmur again. They said, you have killed the people of the Lord, speaking to Moses. Perhaps they thought that the incense offering was Moses' idea And Moses presented this idea because he knew they'd get killed. And so you've killed the people of the Lord. Perhaps the fact that he prayed, don't respect their offerings, they perceive is what caused the death of these 250. But the people apparently totally ignore the responsibility of the 250 and their leaders. In verse 10, this outcry and this murmuring provokes the Lord. And guess what? He tells Moses and Aaron, separate from the people. I'm going to wipe them out again. But again, Moses intercedes. I'm going to suggest to you that a lot of times, maybe all the time, when God spoke to Moses and says, step aside, let me wipe these people out, maybe it's because he wants to see what Moses is going to do. How long-suffering is Moses? And what we see in this is, Moses being a prototype of the Messiah, we see how long-suffering the Messiah really is. That he is willing to stand in the gap. But at any rate, perhaps, God's statement, time and again, to step aside, let me wipe these people out, is a challenge to Moses. Or maybe even we could glean that it's a challenge to us, that we understand that the Creator is long-suffering. He forgives again and again and again and again. Yeshua is asked, how many times should I forgive my neighbor? Seven times? And Yeshua says, not seven times, seven times 70. In other words, again and again and again and again. Now in verse 11, as this is going on, Aaron is instructed to quickly take his fire pan, lay incense upon it in order to atone for the people, because Moses says the plague or a wrath has gone out from the Lord and a plague has already started among the people. And so guess what? Moses uses the incense service, the very thing that they, the people, equated with death. He uses the incense service through Aaron to show the people that it also provides life. They associate it with death. He's proving to them it's associated with life. And so the incense service, of course, plays a very vital role in the atonement ritual that we find in Leviticus 16 with the Day of Atonement. And so some people, when they look at the Day of Atonement with the goats and all this kind of stuff, would focus on the death. But actually, the Day of Atonement is about life. The incense service, very critical in the atonement ritual. These people, many of them anyway, associated it with death. But Moses is wanting to underscore the fact that it should be associated with life. It just depends on what is in the person's heart. See, judgment is not necessarily a bad thing. It just depends on what side of the law you're on. Because when two people go into a courtroom, assuming there is a just judge, the one who is on the right side of the law will be vindicated. The one who's on the wrong side of the law will have a sentence and a decision against him. So likewise, the incense service, yes, resulted in death for some. But I would argue it's because of what was in their heart. Whereas the incense service also provides for life, depending on what's in your heart. And so in verse 13, Aaron does this, and he ends up, it says, standing between the dead and the living. So apparently, only the high priest could stop the plague by standing before wrath. And if we look at Yeshua, of course, as being our heavenly high priest, only he can stop it. Only he can deflect the wrath. He's the one who stands between the living and the dead. At this point, to settle this once and for all, the tribes are then told that a prince from each tribe is to present a rod before the Lord, and that the one that God chooses will cause the rod to bud. This was done in order to cause the murmurings to cease. Now, in verse 23, we are told that the rod of Aaron budded, it blossomed, and it bore ripe almonds. And just kind of a footnote or a point of interest, the word bore is related to the word gimel or gamal. Gamal is the word for camel. Camels are burden bearers. Gimel is a letter of the Hebrew Aleph Bet, and so it alludes to the bearing of fruit, in this particular case, ripe almonds. So then, the one that God has chosen bears fruit. And in bearing fruit, he bears burdens. And ultimately, we see this in Yeshua. But we should also glean from this that our responsibility is to bear fruit, and in bearing fruit, to bear burdens, to take up our cross and follow him, to die to ourselves. That's how we produce fruit, and that is indicative of the one that the Creator has chosen. Now, another thing to glean from this is that when they put these rods in there, only Aaron's rod budded and blossomed and bloomed and produced fruit. But the fact is, this stick produced fruit. And so something that appeared to be inanimate and something that appeared to be dead actually produced fruit. Why? Because it was in the presence of life. There is a legend that in the days of the temple, in Solomon's temple, that all the things, the carvings that had been used in the decor of the temple inside, actually begin to grow and actually begin to produce fruit. Now, it's a legend, but it's an interesting legend. Because apparently things that appear to be dead, when they're placed in God's presence, can blossom, can bud, and can produce fruit. Now, when the Aaron's rod was brought out, the people looked upon it, and there's now no doubt who God has chosen to be the high priest, and that is Aaron. God had chosen the one who had borne fruit. And so then the rod was to be placed before the Ark of the Covenant as a token, it says, and the word is ot, aleph, vav, tav, ot, or sign, as a sign to remind them not to murmur against God and not to murmur against his chosen vessels. Later on, of course, the pot of manna was stored in the Mishkan as well, and later in the temple. And that too was a reminder of sorts, because the people had disdained both of these items. They disdained the manna in favor of the food of Egypt. They disdained Aaron in favor of Korah, or what have you. And ultimately, both of these things are that they disdained what God was wanting to do. And so they were placed before the ark to be a reminder. Now, the people's response to this latest event is they're now fearful. They're fearful that anyone who happens too close to the Mishkan is going to die, that there is no proper way to approach. And yet, there is a proper way to approach. And that means that we are to die. Yes, if we approach God, we die. But what I mean by that is, when we approach God, we die to our flesh. Flesh can't glory in his presence. So, consequently, flesh must die. But if we are willing to die to ourselves and die to our flesh, that's how we can approach the Creator. But nonetheless, speaking to the people's fears and concerns, in the next chapter, the Levites are reminded that they are to safeguard the Mishkan to prevent someone from dying who just happens to stray too close. In verse 1 of chapter 18, it is reiterated that Aaron and the Levites have the responsibility to safeguard the sanctuary. And as I said, that's perhaps given in response to the people's fears, because by doing their job, the Levites would protect Israel from an outcome that we've just experienced here. And it becomes very clear in the text that where the Levites were to safeguard the Mishkan and protect Israelites, the priests were to safeguard the holies and protect the Levites. In other words, there are those who are set apart from those who are already set apart from those who are set apart. The Levites are to safeguard the people, or the Mishkan, and protect the people. The priests are to safeguard the holy things and protect the Levites. In verse 19, we see that there is an everlasting covenant made with the priest. It is a covenant of salt. And the reason it's called a covenant of salt is because salt is something that doesn't go bad. It's eternal, and it protects from anything becoming rancid and being putrid. And so it symbolizes permanence. And so what he was saying is, in verse 19, that the offerings that were presented by Israel are given to the priests for forever. It's a covenant of salt. In verse 21, it says that the Levites are cared for as they safeguard the Mishkan, and so as a consequence protect the Israelites. Well, the Israelites, in turn, bring one-tenth of their crops, and they give it to the Levites. And this is called the first tithe, because it's taken from the crops, and it goes exclusively to the Levites. Now, there are other tithes. There's the second tithe, and there's the tithe of the poor, but the first tithe is the one that goes exclusively to the Levites. In fact, those other tithes don't go to the Levites. Verse 26, the Levites were then instructed to set apart a tithe of the tithe for the Lord, or in other words, the priests. They were not to use the tithe that the people presented to them until they had taken a tithe of that tithe and given it to the priests. That's how it was done. But after it was done, after they had fulfilled that, then they could eat of what had been presented to them, and they would bear no sin, which would infer that if they didn't take the tenth of the tenth and give it to the priest, that they would have been sinning by eating those things. So this is where this Torah portion comes to a close. A rebellion of the people and those who've been given the responsibility to safeguard those things that are holy are validated, they are vindicated. And in a sense, after all is said and done, now, because I've made it very clear who I have chosen and who is holy, therefore, you believe what Moses said, and you bring the tenth of your produce and you give it to those people who have been given the charge of safeguarding the Mishkan and, as a consequence, protecting you from approaching and dying in a plague. So we come to the end of this Torah portion, and we want to thank you for joining us. Hope you've gleaned something from it. Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BuiltCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BuiltCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.